Yeah.
But there's going to be another movie, you know?
Yeah.
And the next movie would be the next job.
Yeah.
You know, it's
the Journal Inquirer was already saying.
Well, I mean,
yeah, this big thing, that's what
they have. And I mean, it's also she's 22. It's like their lives when they were old.
Okay, we ready? Yes. Anyone handing anything in? I'll collect them now.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
Everybody does it.
I'm going to give you your next lab activity.
All right.
Thank you. Anyone else handing anything in? I want to give you this before I forget. Your next lab activity is sort of two in one. You're going to deal with refraction. Hello? Refraction and reflection.
It's a Monday. We don't want to get started.
It's Monday for me, too.
So you should agree, yeah.
Nah. All right, pay attention, because this lab is another one that has something that we're going to work together as a group. It's called Schnell's Law. And for those of you who haven't had Trig, or if those of you who didn't know what I just said, that's why we're going to go over it as a group. But when you work through this, the answer sheet is, again, in online, and don't draw on here or write on here. This is the beginning of the foundation of knowledge you need when we talk about telescopes, okay? And that's coming up in the lectures within the next couple of days. So let me give this to you. Did you go over there on Friday? Or when was it? Thursday? When did you go Wednesday? Huh? No, not for your lab, for the your special project. All right, talk to me after class because I have a special project for you.
It was not just the movie, it was just the whole marketing technique and the whole, it went back to the 30s kind of, the 40s kind of
horror. Ah, here we go.
It's not like,
oh, so
not
like,
thank you.
You're welcome.
I don't remember.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Yeah, that was the whole thing. This guy, Dal Newton, made a lot of horror movies in the 40s.
Alrighty.
Except the earrings.
I know you're all excited because it's Christopher Columbus Day. Guy got a bad rap. Yeah, he got a bad rap. He knew where he was going. He was an excellent navigator. Okay. Today we're going to continue with where we left off last time. We're picking up... there's some familiar names now you're coming to hear about. And so we're getting in during the Renaissance period and onward. Science is being established in the form that we're familiar with it today. I told you a little bit about Leonardo da Vinci's points of view on such things. And again, he didn't publish his stuff. Apparently he was going to, but he never got around to it. He just never did. And his notebooks were scattered all over, so now we're rediscovering this stuff. And he was onto some interesting things. And some people speculate what our science would be like today if he was in the mix with the likes of Kepler and Newton, and the people before them, and Copernicus. So today, we continue with Galileo. And that reminds me, next Friday, we will have a major activity at night at the observatory that deals with Galileo and Galileo's telescope. And why this is going to be special, I had a couple of years ago started something I called the Lecture Under the Stars series, and I brought some of my colleagues from the astronomical community in, who are big hitters. You know, they deal with the Mars stuff and the Vatican Pope Scope. I had the director of that here, and there was a huge range of backgrounds that were exposed to the people that came to these lectures. So this will probably be my last one, and I'll be giving the talk on Galileo. And what's really cool about this is that this is the International Year of Astronomy, okay, 2009, and it's worldwide. So there's activity going on throughout this past year all over the place. A couple of people got together, several scientists, opticians in Tucson, and they decided it would be neat if they could design and have built an inexpensive telescope along the lines of Galileo's telescope and have it ready for this year. And the idea was to get as many of these into the hands of kids as possible worldwide. So they made special deals with different organizations that would buy these and just give them out to kids so that the kids would have a telescope similar in diameter and optical gathering properties as Galileo's scope, although these are far superior than the one Galileo used. And the clarity of the image is far superior. The lenses, typically in an inexpensive telescope, would be made of plastic. These are glass lenses, so it's easy to put together. And we're going to have a drawing on that night, and I'm giving away 80 of them. So the idea is to, if you have kids and you know people with kids, to have them get a ticket. It's free. So as people come in, they can get a ticket. You know, put one half in the big jar or whatever, and if you have chocolate chip cookies, I'll put your ticket in a special place, and so you'll win a telescope. No.
Are there going to be telescopes for sale also? Or?
No. It's just so the 80, and so you don't win one, you don't get one. You can buy one on your own if you want. But the idea is to get families involved in this thing. And what's also going to be interesting, if you want to, you can assemble it. It only takes about 10 minutes to put together, and you can actually use it that night to look at Jupiter. Now, some of you have used Jupiter as one of your observations, so Jupiter is well placed next week for that. And, of course, the observatory will be opened, and it's going to be, it should be fun. So, so today we'll talk about Galileo and give you a little bit of insight on what this man was all about. First of all, he accepted the Copernican theory. And what's that? What's the Copernican theory? And we talk about the solar system.
Sun-centered.
Okay. And why he did that was for no other reason than he looked at Jupiter through his telescope, and he found four objects that orbited Jupiter. And his reasoning was something like this. If obviously something big can have something smaller going around it, then the sun, which is big, it would make sense that the earth would go around it. And then Copernicus's ideas were, his mathematics supported that. So we now have observational data as well as theoretical data, and Galileo just said, yeah, makes sense, it's simple, Kepler's ideas fit in, everything fits in. So when things start to fit, then maybe that's the way you want to deal with stuff. Now, people will say Galileo didn't invent the telescope. Well, I say he invented the astronomical telescope, and he perfected it for use in astronomy. There were telescopes. Now, what's interesting about this story is Galileo caught wind of this device that a guy named Hans Lippershey, who was an optician, put together a spy scope. You use it on land and look at ships and stuff. And he thought this was cool, and he started working on his own design. And he was trying to convince some of the higher ups that this might be an important thing. The higher ups were some of his friends who happened to be cardinals in the church. And one of his close friends actually became a pope. So he was well connected. with a hierarchy. And of course, his position was precarious because now he's about to challenge the common knowledge about how things move. He was challenging Aristotle. So Galileo ends up getting himself in a position where he's not going to win. Well, the story goes, one of his telescopes that he built, he was in Venice at the time, and he wanted to show all the big shots that this is an important thing. You could use it to see at a distance, so if anyone's coming toward you, you know about it a lot sooner than, you don't have to wait so long. So he used the telescope and to show them, was in St. Mark's Square in Venice, apparently, and then looked at the distant church. The top had a cross on it, and when you look through this type of telescope, it inverts the image. So you had an upside down cross now. So that's a sign of the devil. So the devil glass. So he's already got one strike down. So again, this is Ida Baez's naive history in terms of the myths of Galileo. But he did a lot of this. He showed people things that he was discovering, not only with the telescope, but how things move. And again, once people get in their heads about how things are supposed to be, it's very difficult to change minds. Galileo what Kepler was like. Galileo was the opposite. Kepler was, little mealy-mouthed, closed-in sort of person. Galileo was gregarious, loud, Italian, right? Typical Italian. And I should know. So, opinionated, and get into a good argument with you when necessary, but never hit anybody, because that's how you do it. You can yell, but you can't hit. So he was working with a number of ideas, and as he was expounding on these things, now Galileo never completed college, right? He never got his degree, and one of the reasons for that was Galileo's father, Vincenzo, wanted Galileo to be a doctor, medical doctor. So remember, when you were a male, you had some options. Now, you had to be legitimate. If you were a bastard, you were born out of wedlock, that's a bastard, you didn't have any status, but your parents could buy you status, except if you were a woman. If you were a girl and you were born out of wedlock, then you became a nun, unless you were really beautiful and somebody married you off. And they had a big... So anyway, it was complicated. But Galileo, his father wanted him to study medicine. So he went to university, and he was taking his math courses, and he really liked math. To him, it was just a natural thing. So he wanted to study math, and his father's paying for him to become medical doctor. And of course, like, your parents want you to be something, and they're paying the bill, and then you decide you want to be something else, and they probably say, oh, no more money. That happened to Galileo. But he continued working with his professors and studying math, and eventually working with things that move and trying to understand this. He became a professor at Padua, where he was a student, and he continued to teach mathematics and motion and doing experiments in these various fields. Galileo never got married, but he had a girlfriend, yes.
Did they call it physics back then?
It was natural philosophy, okay, and the natural philosophy of motion, and the word exactly used in that term really didn't come about yet. It was probably floating around, but it wasn't attached like we use it today. So Galileo and his girlfriend managed to have three kids, and then they parted ways. He had two daughters and a son, so they were all illegitimate by the rules, and he was able to get his son sort of legitimized, and his daughters, he just didn't have enough money, so he gave them an option, they can go become nuns. And both his daughters went into the nunnery, and then when they turned, as they turned 16, then they had to commit or leave, and they decided they'd stay. And one of his daughters, Maria Celeste, her name was Virginia, and she took the nun name Maria Celeste, Celeste the Sky, in honor of her father. She really loved her dad, and Galileo was very close to his kids, especially Maria Celeste. She was in a nunnery in Florence, and Galileo actually took a house close by, and he would, on a weekly basis, walk over to the nunnery and fix things for them. He fixed the clock, and his daughter would sew up some things for him, but it was a very poor order of nuns. I mean, they took vow of poverty, they really had nothing, but during the outbreaks of the plague that would occur throughout this time period in Europe, that little area, they were very healthy. His daughter studied herbs and pharmaceutical type things, and she would mix up all sorts of things and help keep the people healthy, and they'd grow all their own food, and she'd make medicines for her dad. And so it was a very crazy time. If you're interested in what was like to live in that period of time, what Galileo was like, he wrote to his daughter, and she wrote back to him a series of letters. The letters that survive were Galileo's letters from his daughter. His letters to her, she was very fearful that if the church found out, you know, what they were talking about, that the convent where she was would have been closed down. That's the mental outlook was at the time. You didn't want to piss off anybody who was in charge, because no matter who you were, you'd have problems. So his letters to her are gone, unless they turn up in a shoebox someplace. They're gone. Her letters to him survived. And a woman by the name of Dava Sobel, wrote a book called Galileo's Daughter. Excellent, excellent book. If you're interested in what time period was all about and the relationship between Galileo and his daughter, it's a really, really good book to read, because it's all the letters in translation from the original Italian. So he was torn. He had things to say. When he would write stuff, he took a little departure. Instead of writing in Latin at the scholarly level, he would write in Italian. And Italian was the common language of Italy, starting to become established as the language of everyone in Italy. And so what that did was open up all of these new ideas to the general populace. So Galileo became very popular. So he was a popular person, but he was also very religious, very devout Catholic. Right? He didn't want to do anything that would harm the church. And yet, the church said that he was harming the church. Now, most of it was political. And during his long life, he would publish a number of things, but eventually got into trouble with the Pope, who was his friend before he became Pope. I guess once you become Pope, you get really busy, especially then. You know, today you hear about generals and armies, and the generals are sitting someplace figuring stuff out. Then if you were the Pope and you were the general of the Pope's army, you were out there with your shield and your sword right in the middle of all this stuff. So you get pretty busy. And during that time, the church was under attack. And, you know, it was just crazy. So you read about that history and you get a sense that how did anybody make it through this time, right? Let alone people like Galileo trying to determine what nature's all about. So anyhow, Galileo, before he would publish anything, you had to have it approved by essentially the church. They had a committee, and the committee would read your stuff, and if it was approved, they'd stamp it, the imprimatur it's called, and then that means that anybody can read the book, and there's not going to be anything in there that has anything to do with heresy, or you're not going to challenge any of the belief systems of the church. The theology would be intact. So Galileo lived in Florence. Florence, take a train, fast train, get there in a couple hours to Rome. All right. During that time, you know, it's like further from here to Phoenix, and you're going by horseback. So it takes you a week, 10 days, to get from one place to another. Well, they had little offices of the official inquisitors to read the books and give the stamps. But each town, now Italy wasn't a complete country yet. They had all these little city-state-like things, okay? So you had regions, Florence, Venice, Rome, and so they will be at war every once in a while with each other, but they're starting to unite as one big country. So anyhow, and of course the church united the whole thing through the church. So there was the political side, and then there's the religious side. So Galileo's writing his stuff. He's in Florence. he had some malady that periodically he would get very ill and would be out of commission. And we don't understand exactly what that might have been, but from some indication based on the symptoms that people recorded, you know, when they saw him, he probably had severe bouts of hay fever, you know, allergies. And it would just wipe him out for weeks at a time. And he couldn't travel, he couldn't do anything very well during that time. Well, anyhow, he had one of his books stamped by the local people in Venice, and Rome was supposed to get a copy of this stuff. Well, when it was on its way, the bubonic plague had a flare-up, and so when that happened, they would seal off all the roads in and out of the villages. And the word you're familiar with, quarantine, comes from that period of time. Quaranta means 40 in Italian. They'd seal it off for 40 days. And then during that time, they would also burn any organic material, clothing, cloth, anything that would be able to support the bacteria or whatever was going on, the virus. They knew enough that they would burn it, they would stop at least moving it from place to place. So Galileo's stuff never got to where it was supposed to, so some people accused him of writing an improper book and didn't get the approvals. Anyhow, it was a comedy of errors. So at some point, Galileo was called to Rome by the Inquisition. Right? During this time, he couldn't travel. He said, look, I'll come there, but I can't travel right now. You will travel, or we're going to come and get you and put you in chains and take you. So he found one of his friends in high places, another priest type, sent a cart for him, put him in a cart, and then took him in stages, and he was able to rest along the way. And he finally made it to Rome and hung around for a while, and then he was essentially put on trial for what his book were, the books that were about. One of the books, they made the case that he was making fun of the Pope, because he was using a style that the Greeks used, the dialogues, when you'd have a number of people who would, you'd have, it's like a main character, and then you would have two sides of the story. You would have somebody who never get it, and somebody who's going to get it if you explain it properly. So the one who never gets it, in his book's called Simplicito. Simplicito, in translation roughly from Italian, means the idiot. Okay, the simpleton, and never going to get it. And someone, one of the cardinals who didn't like Galileo, said he was talking about the Pope. You see, that the Pope's busy doing his Pope stuff, and I mean these guys were close, because the Pope, before he was the Pope, they would talk about art and science and all the poetry and all these wonderful things that, you know, you wonder about. And so he never really had a chance to, and he didn't talk to Galileo during that period of time. When he came back, Galileo was in trouble. Remember Giordano Bruno? They burned him at the stake? That could have happened to Galileo, but he was very popular. If that happened, there would have been an uprising. One of the interesting things about Rome, and even to this day, you live in Italy, you live in Rome, the Pope is the priest of a parish in that area. So he's just like any other priest to Italians, right? Of course he's the Pope, so that's special. But he's still a parish priest and still has to deal with that stuff. So you have a different perspective. You get away from that, you know, the Pope, oh, this big guy, right? Anyhow, Galileo was in this situation and he was in trouble. So he had a choice. Either renounce what he was talking about. Well, first they put a qualifier on this. They said to him, you could talk about Copernicus's stuff, but you have to talk about it as theory. In other words, we don't know if the sun is really in the center. Now, they knew the sun was at the center. These were educated people. What they feared more than anything is that if the church was challenged, if Aristotle was challenged, they would start losing control. Remember, they already had a big bout with the Protestants that formed, you see? So they were losing control. The entire society was centered on the church. So they had political as well as religious control. They knew times were a-changing, so to speak, but they wanted the information to go out in a controlled way, so you didn't have people just going nuts. That's what they thought would happen. So they said to Galileo, you can talk about Copernicus's ideas in the context of a theory, and make sure you do it in Latin, so it just stays at the scholarly level. All right? We don't want everybody to know what's going on here. And so he pretty much said, yeah, I could do that. And you also have to confess that you were a heretic in a sense. The words weren't as strong, and he had to write a confession. And for all of that, they didn't burn him at the stake. They put him essentially under house arrest. Now, they were going to throw him in jail, but some of his other top buddies came by and said, no, he could stay here, Landed up back in Florence next to his... next to the convent where his daughter was, so they still had contact. And Galileo stayed there the rest of his life, continued doing experiments. When he died, he was practically completely blind. Again, we don't know what was going on there, but he may have had diabetes and complicated with these other minor things. And people say, no, he was looking through his telescope at the sun. Well, that's not what he did. He used to project the image of the sun, and when he did his sunspot works, onto a screen. So as the other peoples who we spoke of, Tycho Brahe, Kepler, people at that time had to have sponsors, essentially. It was like the beginning of the funding of science. So Galileo's big sponsors were essentially the Medici family. And if you look at the history of them, there were a couple of them who were really off the wall. But he named the four, what we call the Galilean satellites, the Medici stars, in honor of the Medici. So I kept his money coming, right? So he knew how to play the game. And but another neat myth, when Galileo confessed, apparently a lot of his students thought that he sold out, that he shouldn't have done that. So the story goes that when he was working on his experiments in his home, the only people that could see him would have been the priestly class. So some of his students who became Jesuits, the story goes, would go see him. And you know, the flowing robes and that they wear. So they would go see him. There was a god outside his house. So he would be working on something, and the story goes, when they would come in, he'd shovel all his stuff in their robes. They'd go out and have it published outside of Italy. And so Galileo became known all over Europe. And so he was like the first, in the modern sense, scientist who published material and made a dent in knowledge, and he influenced a great number of people. So he eventually he died off. He was put in a temporary tomb for a while, and then he was moved to one of the major churches in Florence, where he's got this big elaborate tomb. And also, there's another interesting piece of Galileo's life that still is above ground. And I'll tell you about that at the talk next Friday. Okay, so let's see. In 1633, Galileo is 64 years old. And this is when he was invited to the Inquisition. Invited, right? Mm. Hi, you were invited to participate in your demise.
My greetings.
Greetings, yeah. Invited to the Inquisition in Rome. And I told you what happened there. Now, a twist to the story. About 10 years ago, they opened up Galileo's case again. Now, you have to understand, this was a very formal legal process. All right, it wasn't a kangaroo court. Okay, yeah, you're guilty. Boom. There was a legal process. There were ecclesiastical lawyers, the lawyers for the Vatican. They took notes. They had records of the trials. So that's all in the Vatican. So it was opened up about 10, 12 years ago. They reviewed all the records and they said, you know what? Galileo was framed. You know, he actually didn't do the things that were in the record. When you look at all this, he was framed. There were a group of people really didn't like him, a group of cardinals, and they framed Galileo. Because remember, he was very religious. He wanted to do everything by the book. And he had a choice. He could have denounced the church or accepted what the church, and he accepted what the church had to say. But he knew they were wrong in terms of what was going on. So he's off the hook now. All right, so and it's also bizarre because at the same time all this was going on, Galileo is now opening up the science of astronomy. And the church established the Vatican Observatory, which still exists here. And in Arizona, the Pope's scope is on Mount Graham. So how do you do this? Again, when people know that something is good and they're understanding something, it continues in spite of all the stuff that tries to knock it down. It's almost like, yeah, the truth will set you free. Or what did Mulder used to say? The truth is out there, I don't know, on the X-Files, right?
376 years later,
He's off the hook. So the Galileo's off the hook. He was quite an interesting prick. What's that?
Don't get arrested by the church. You'll be waiting a while.
Well, the thing is, again, it wasn't a religious problem as much as a political one, because the whole society was built around the church. And that's what gave it the structure. And during this time, again, if you use the Dark Ages, that term that historians will like to use, but Europe was coming out of this period of very interesting non-educational situation. So the church was holding it together. The universities were established by the church. You know, and so this was the continuation of the knowledge that people had. So it was a very weird situation to be in. And did this have an effect on Italians doing science? Oh yeah, it did. All of a sudden, you don't see, well, Alessandro Volta, his one guy that's working with frog's legs making batteries, you know, a little time after that. And then there's this quiet from this area. So rather curious, and they started picking up in the 1800s and the 1900s. But very, very devastating. Next one in line, Isaac Newton. For those of you who like coincidences, Isaac Newton was born the year Galileo died. Newton also dealt with how things move, and he's picked up where Galileo left off, literally, in terms of Galileo's work. But all these people have interesting stories, I'll tell you. When Newton was, when he was born, they thought he was going to die. He was going to make it through the night. He was a premature baby. And the nurse that delivered him said that he was so small he could fit in a big teacup. So he wasn't doing well, but even at birth he was tenacious, as he was his entire life. And he made it through the night, and he continued, and he had a nice home for a few years as a kid. His father died, and his mother picked up with the local vicar, and they shacked up somewhere. He got shipped off to his grandma, and his mother dumped the vicar after a while because figured all he wanted was her money, and went back. And so there's Isaac back with his mom and all his dad's books. And he continued on, very smart kid apparently, went on, got his degree. But Newton had an interesting side that you don't normally hear about. Newton also was very religious. But he wasn't Catholic, because by this time you got the Church of England, which was close to Catholicism, but not right there. Newton was a mystic. He was into mysticism. And alchemy fascinated him, you know, changing lead into gold type of stuff. He was part of a group that would have philosophical discussions, theological discussions, about the nature of God. Was God three beings in one, you know, the Trinity? Or was God just one, the Unitarians and the Trinitarians? And there would be these arguments back and forth. And during this time, even learned people, I say that like if you wrote about a religion you weren't learned. No, that's not what I mean. I mean the arguments that they would present had to do with such things as how big is hell? What are the physical dimensions of hell? These would be, you would have a lecture, and you would be invited to come to a lecture. Yes, I've got the dimension of, according to what Dante said in the Inferno, you can calculate the volume of hell. And how many angels fit on the head of a pin? These were legitimate philosophical, theological arguments at the time. Okay? And this is where science came out of. Right? You know, maybe that's why it came out of it, because there were some questions you just don't have answers to.
How come Newton wrote in Latin then?
He wrote in English.
Well, Principia was Latin.
Yeah, well, again, you write it to your audience. So if it's based on... what's the word I want? On an educational... professional level, then you would write in that point, but he would also write in English. So Newton had to walk softly because he knew what happened to these people in history who challenge anything. And now you've got the Protestant church, and they were just as bad as the Catholics. You still didn't challenge anything, right? And it's almost like today, where you challenge anybody, you're in trouble if you're not on the right side. So nothing changed. Nothing has changed. In terms of planetary motion, he concluded that gravity, this is what Galileo was working with, that gravity was the force that held the planets in orbit about the sun. Kepler, you recall, did not know how that came to be, how the planets would stay around the sun. But now Newton says, it's gravity. Yeah, well then the question is, what's gravity? So he didn't answer that question, because he really didn't want to answer, and I'll show you why in a second. The force that held the planets in orbit about the sun. And here's why Newton really didn't like gravity. Watch closely. Nothing here. Nothing. Nothing here. But watch what happens. Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Absolutely woo, because Newton was a very mechanistic individual. If things are going to move, they've got to be physically pushed. You see? If I'm going to move this screen, I've got to physically push it. I can't sit here and do that and think it moving. I've got to be in physical contact. Newton was of the mind that said the universe is like a mechanical device that it was wound up by God, right? And now it's just winding out and doing its thing. But it had a definite beginning where it got wound up. And everything that moves touches something else that moves. And even though he developed, as we'll see eventually, the universal law of gravity that we call it, he didn't like this because there's nothing, he couldn't explain how that happened. So he just ignored that and came up with the mathematics to describe it and said, I really don't know what it is, I don't care what it is, but here's how it works in terms of if you have two things, this is how they'll be attracted. So very interesting. He was a skinflint, cheap. He didn't have a family. He had nieces and nephews, but he wasn't married. And he was so cheap that when he would write stuff down, he'd never publish it because it costs money to publish it. But there's the old myth about Newton sitting under an apple tree one day when the bubonic plague was running through England, through the city of London. They moved out to their country house. He was in 20s or so, and he's sitting on the ice. See, you guys, you're 20. What are you doing here? You're taking notes about Newton. You know what he did when he was 20? Invented calculus. So Times are different. So Newton, sitting under a tree, gets clonked on the head with an apple while he's looking at the moon. And supposedly, that's the connection he made between the apple falling and the moon falling around the earth, gravity pulling on things, you see? So...
Did he name it gravity?
No, Galileo used the word. Gravity, it comes from the Latin word gravitas, mean heavy. And of course, when you use the word like that, then the implication is heavier things will fall faster than lighter things. That's not how it goes. So it's one of those things that that the way you name the word is not the way the object works. What's the opposite of gravity?
Anti-gravity.
No. You know the word. You just never thought of it this way. Levity. Happy. Levity. Up. Right? That's the opposite of gravity. Light. Levity means light. Gravity means heavy. So, here's Newton working on this stuff. Now, one of these odd things. There's a Japanese biological company that actually cloned that tree. They found that, I don't know, this tree is still alive after all these years, apparently, or maybe an offspring of that tree, and they cloned it. So you could buy a clone of Newton's tree. The whole thing's a myth anyway. Whether he sat under this tree, who knows? But
it's like buying plots on the moon.
That's exactly right. I have some for sale, by the way. You want mine? So during this time when he was in the country area, he was working with this idea about moving and what Galileo had done. And Newton needed a quick way of representing algebra. So essentially he invented calculus to help him with rates of rates. As things change, how do they change against each other? And out of necessity, he invented calculus. If they had calculators then, I don't think they'd invent calculus. Because you didn't have to do all this pencil and paper stuff. But he didn't write anything. He didn't publish stuff. 20 years later, a guy named Leibniz invented calculus. But in those intervening 20 years, Newton made a name for himself. He was almost like Aristotle. And there was a big war between him and Leibniz about who invented calculus. I guess the symbolism in calculus used today is mostly Newtonian, but they've got some Leibniz stuff in there. I don't know the exact what pieces. Do you know? Did you ever come across that?
I understood that he invented the integral calculus first through gravity, and from that came around then the differential calculus, which is just phenomenal.
Yeah. So there was this battle, but the most important aspect of all this, not publishing his stuff, is a friend of his by the name of Edmund Halley was convinced that this comet that would come back every 76 years was the same one. And at this time, Kepler's laws were understood, Newton generated his ideas of gravity, universal law of gravity, and Halley was convinced it was the same comet. So what he did was he asked Newton, listen, if you help me with this problem, I want to combine Galileo's ideas of motion, Kepler's laws of planetary motion, your idea of gravity, I want to combine them all to come up with the ability to predict, based on the position of this comet, when it's going to return again. Because they had this stuff from its previous apparition. And so Newton said, why do I want to do that? And he said, well, if you do it, I'll pay to have your stuff published. And Newton said, okay, sounds good to me. So they did. Okay, so I devise naive history, but it's essentially that's how it turned out. Halley got the help he needed. He did his calculations, predicted when this comet was going to come back. Halley didn't live to see it, but people were waiting. They knew where to look because he predicted where on the sky they should see it, around what date, and they did. And Halley's comet is named in honor of Edmund Halley. That wouldn't have happened if Newton wasn't a cheapskate and Halley didn't publish his stuff. So I sound like Sherman and the Professor Peabody on the. So this reminds me of. You're too young, most of you, but there was a Rocky and Bullwinkle. You ever see Rocky and Bullwinkle? You know who Rocky and Bullwinkle are?
Yeah.
Okay, and there's this little... all right, I'll shut up. Well, anyhow, we'll talk more about Newton and Galileo when we talk about telescopes. But the next thing we're going to look at is... because we're talking about planetary configurations in the solar system. And I'm going to give you some terms that by now I think you probably can almost guess what the definitions are going to be. You've had enough exposure to making measurements on the sky. And so let's go ahead and define a couple of terms for you. These terms come directly from the astrological definitions of these things. Okay? So planetary terms and elongation. You want to take a guess at what that is?
Stretching out.
Okay, that's a good beginning. Stretching out. But what angle do you normally think of when you think of stretching out? You think of an angle between things, right?
An angle between the Earth, the planet, and the sun.
Yeah. So here we go. That would be defined as the angular separation between a planet and sun as seen from Earth. Now let's see who's paying attention to the night sky. What will the elongation be between Jupiter and the Sun when Jupiter finally reaches the western horizon? And when you get up and look for it, it's on the western horizon. What will be coming up on that day? The Sun, and what's the elongation?
180
degrees. Okay? Suppose you're looking at the first quarter moon. What's the elongation of the first quarter moon when it's on your meridian and the sun setting? 90 degrees. Okay? Good. All right. You sit there, you give me the answer, and you have this look on your face like, I really know that. How is it? Then we use another term, the greatest elongation. And guess what that means? It's the same as elongation, but the greatest one, it's the largest angle that you can have. So this would be the largest angular separation. And then we can have the greatest eastern or western elongation. And of course, you see east and west. That's referring to the horizon, right? And when the sun and the planet will be and have the greatest elongation. So, for example, a full moon, you could say, has the greatest eastern elongation. It's east of the sun. See. And it's 180 degrees, and that's the biggest it's going to be, and then it'll stay that way. And then, of course, you can go in the opposite direction and have the greatest elongation. But what's the moon doing there? That would be when it would be setting. The full moon is setting, and the moon is rising. With the planets, it doesn't happen over the same night. It'll happen over months. All right, and then we have opposition. What's that? What do you think opposition is? Yeah. This has a very specific definition. And opposition is what you expect. It's opposite. Well, what's opposite? This is going to be defined in terms of a description that I'll have to tell you. When a superior planet, now this doesn't mean that it's superior in any other sense other than where it's located in its orbit around the sun. When a superior planet is on the other side of the sun, from Earth. And now what do I mean by the other side? Well, I'll put the sun in the middle. If it's in opposition, what's its elongation? 180 degrees. So you could put the sun, the Earth in the middle, right? of the orientation when it looks, when you look out on the sky. Okay? And in conjunction with this is another one called conjunction. Give you a hint. What's conjunction? Now, here, superior planet means a planet that's outside the orbit of the Earth. Right? If it's inside the orbit of the Earth, there's only two planets that fit that bill,
right.
Mercury and Venus. You can never have opposition because it just can never have an elongation of 180 degrees. It's going to have a maximum elongation. For example, I don't know how early you get up in the morning, but if you're up early enough, just before the sun's up, you can see Venus. And right now, Venus is heading toward the sun. It's going to eventually become in conjunction, but Venus can never be in opposition. You'll never see Venus 180 degrees opposite the sun. You'll see maybe 23 degrees, whatever it is, I don't remember off the top of my head. But you'll see it at some angle, and it won't get any further away from the sun than that, because Venus is an inferior planet. It's inside the Earth's orbit, so you can never see it in opposition to the sun. So this is when the object is in the direction of the sun, or what is its elongation?
0 degrees.
Elongation is 0 degrees. Opposition elongation is 180 degrees. Then there's... Go ahead.
Why for the inferiors can't they be in opposition?
Maybe if you draw a little picture might help. Here's the sun. Here's the Earth. Here's an inferior planet. Okay. As you watch the inferior planet orbiting from... And we'll just sort of freeze this at various points. Because you're looking at it from here. Okay? That's it. That's the maximum angle you can get. Let's have a planet out here. It can be opposite the sun. This can never get opposite the sun. Do you see it? It's going to get on the other side of the sun. It'll be in conjunction, but it can never be opposite the sun. From Earth, you won't see it. But this planet can be opposite the sun, and you can see it. Yeah. And then it's in conjunction, and then it'll go behind the sun, and you won't see it. So it has to do with that. Do you see it? You got to visualize it. Okay. Another term, quadrature. Guess what that means? That's right. So, when we're talking about circles, so what's a fourth of a circle? How say it? A quarter, but how many degrees would that be?
90.
90 degrees. Yeah, you thought 45 because there's a 4 in 45, huh? 90 degrees, and that's east or western elongation. And they have, from astrology, they break this up into even more pieces, and it gets like, okay, we don't need all that. And but these are just some handy things that you'll see all the time. And now, there are two other definitions that have to do with the position of the object on the sky with relation to two things. One would be the stars, and one would be the sun. So we have two other terms, and the first one is called sidereal period. You may have heard this term, they talk about sidereal time. Okay, sidereal, anytime you see that term, you're talking about the stars. Okay, sidereal period. Period means how much time it takes for something to occur and repeat. And so this will be defined as the actual period of revolution about the sun with respect to the fixed stars. Alright, what this means, if you went outside tonight and you look at a let's say a planet its location, Jupiter's location, to some star, right? And then you start doing a day count. And when you find Jupiter exactly at that same position on the sky, the number of days it took to do that would be the sidereal period. Okay? So you're using the background stars as your reference, against which you're going to plot the motion, for example, of Jupiter. So it's in reference to the stars. And again, of course, we're going around the sun, so the sky is always giving us a different view. Now, the other term is the synodic term, or the synodic period. And this is defined as the actual period of revolution about the sky, with respect to the sun now, and an example of this would be from opposition to opposition. In other words, if you went out and saw Jupiter in opposition to the sun, then you count the number of days when Jupiter is back in opposition. It's like you look at the moon and you look at its time from full moon to full moon, and you count the number of days to go from full moon to full moon. That's the synodic period. As opposed to running outside, seeing where the moon is right now, what stars are behind it, and counting the number of days it takes the moon to get back to that position. Okay? So one is with respect to the background stars, one is with respect to the sun's position in terms of elongation. And indeed, we can measure opposition to opposition or conjunction to conjunction. Okay? So we have two different terms. Sidereal, star, synodic, sun, position against the sun. This thing, they've got more terms than this. People who deal with calendars, I don't know if they're more anal than psychologists and biologists with all their terminologies and their strict definitions, but they get so nitpicky, and you wonder, what is it? I mean, I've seen people argue about they're trying to establish activity in the past using astronomical data, try to move the clock backwards. And then they start with problems that you would say, well, why bother? You know, like, when's day zero? You say, well, who cares? You're going to be a day off one way or another. Oh, no, 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 it's going to make a big deal. We need to have it precisely this. So they invent other terms. They have combinations of sidereal, synodic periods. Then you really have some fun when you deal with trying to position orbits of moons around the planet. Mm-hmm. And is the orbit locked? Is it a synchronous orbit? Does it have a period where it drifts a little bit so that you get this funny sort of shape? And if you try to predict when the next alignment of that star with that the moon is going to be, you might be off a little and you can't predict it. I mean, it's important if you're doing this stuff. But I don't know why people get so crazy over it. Ignorance is bliss. Anyone have... it's important, though, really is. If you're trying to determine, for example, use astronomical data to predict when in the past something has happened, and that might be important. Like when you signed the contract, you didn't mean to sign. If you're an astrologer, you'd know about that. Lights, please. Who didn't get a current lab? Did everyone get the new lab activity? Let's see. Today's Monday. Wednesday, we're going to do the piece of it that you need to see as part of the lecture, okay? And so it'll be due... Say it again?
The other one due today.
Five. Well, that was... when was that due? Last week?
The movie one?
Yeah. What did I say it was due? Yeah, it was due this Wednesday? Yeah, okay. That's fine. I'm not picky on that. Did everyone pick up their stuff on the side table? There's some pictures there as well. Anyone have to sign up for the observatory? Meet me there, I'll be there.
When is the new one due?
The new one is due a week from Wednesday.
Okay.
Oh. turn this off.
See the students answer.